Hello, crackheads. You are listening to Paranormal Cracktivity. I'm Justin.
And I am Dreek.
And welcome to the first episode. Dreek, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling great. So excited.
I'm excited too. I'm also really hot and kind of nervous.
I am one of those things. Guess which one?
What are you drinking tonight, Drake?
What am I drinking tonight? I am drinking some Sutter Home Pink Moscato that DeAndre brought to me last night.
That sounds lovely.
What are you drinking, Justin?
Tonight I am drinking a Cabernet Sauvignon. It's from Top Box. Shout out Top Box, sponsor us.
I only drink things I can spell.
So what do you think the first episode is about, Drake?
Well, I have an inkling that it is about H.H. Holmes.
Oh, you're wrong. It's actually about the Charleston Clap.
You know, this whole week leading up, I was like so excited. I'm like, I'm going to hear about H.H. Holmes. And then we're talking about the Charleston Clap.
No, I'm totally kidding. So actually, I was going to do H.H. Holmes. The problem is there was way too much information and it was all old information. So I did not have enough time to go through all of that and to record, because I felt like for our first recording, we should probably not do like a two-parter, you know?
Yeah, that's splendid idea, actually.
Yeah, so I researched Richard Franklin Speck. Do you know
okay.
him? Have you heard of him?
I've never heard of her.
Him.
Them.
Them. Him. His name is Richard.
Richard. Okay. I don't know a lot of Richards, but the ones I do know, I don't like them.
Yes, his name is Richard. I will be referring to him either as Dick or Speck throughout this episode. So I guess,
or we can do Dick Speck.
Or Dick Speck, that's correct. Yeah, either one.
I think we did a thing.
So I guess I am just gonna go ahead and get started. If you're ready, you ready for my story?
I am ready for your story. I'm super excited.
All right, so we are gonna start out with a quote by Connie Filippelli. Judy Dykton decided to get some early morning studying done for a neurology exam. Steamy July weather had forced Judy to run her fan for days. She switched it off and heard a sound like an animal crying outside. Ignoring it, she decided to do some laundry before hitting the books. Downstairs, she turned on the washer, then headed back upstairs to study. Once more, she heard something. This time, she thought it sounded like a child crying out. She pulled open the blinds and saw a woman across the street at 2319, perched on a ledge. Judy pushed open the window and heard Cora's tearful cry, "Oh my God, they are all dead." This is the story of Richard Speck. So, Richard's parents, his father, Benjamin Franklin, or Frank Speck, was born April 23rd, 1894, in Oklawaka, Illinois. I could
Oklawaka.
Have looked that name up, but I didn't. He was
you're a daredevil.
He was cited in the 1940 census as a laborer, typically working on farms and doing logging work. He was also employed later that year around 1947 by the Western Stoneware Company, which is a pottery manufacturing business. He was employed there as a packer. He was a member of the Keithsburg Christian Church, and he only had an eighth grade education. In January 1921, he married Mary Margaret Carball, who was born on the 12th of June, 1903. Her occupation was listed in the census as a housekeeper. She also only had a middle school education. So Frank, unfortunately, died at the age of 53, I think, on December 29th of 1947 in Monmouth, Illinois, and he died of a heart attack.
Do you know if Frank was a good father?
As far as I know, Frank was a good father. The reports say that he was actually very close with Dick. So, yeah, he was a good father.
Okay, I love that.
Yeah. So Richard had 7 siblings. He had 4 older sisters, 2 older brothers, and 1 younger sister. So one of the older sisters is still living, and so she's going to remain anonymous. And then there's Irma Claire Speck, born 1922, Sarah Madeline Speck Thornton, born 1924, Martha Jane Thornton, born 1926, Robert Coleman Speck, born 1928, William Howard Speck, born 1930, and then a younger sister who's still living, who will also remain anonymous, was born in 1943. Robert, one of Richard's older brothers, actually died young in a car accident at the age of 23.
Age of 23. So what was this, like the 50s?
Yeah, that was 1952.
They shouldn't have been driving.
Should not have been driving, no.
What was it, the 50s?
You better stay off the road in the 50s.
Did they still have horses on the road in the 50s, or was it just like completely automobiles?
I'm sure they had horses in some places. I honestly don't know anything about Illinois, but you know.
It seems pretty like potato-y.
That's what I was thinking too. Maybe like some Amish folk or something. I don't know. We probably just offended a bunch of people. So Richard Benjamin / Franklin Speck was born at 1 a.m. on December 6th, 1941, in Kirkwood, Illinois. He is a Sagittarius sun, Gemini moon, and Virgo rising.
Okay, cool beans.
Fun facts about the year 1941, that is before Hawaii and Alaska became states. Stravinsky published Tango, which is one of the inspirations for our theme song. And then there's also Prokofiev, the year 1941 symphonic suite, which is very scary. I would recommend giving it a listen because it kind of fits, it really fits the bill. It's on brand for us. Also, Placido Domingo was born on January 1st.
I think that's a pretty controversial fact.
Well, anyways. Other things that were going on in the year 1941, World War II.
Okay.
Winston Churchill and all that.
Queen Elizabeth.
No. We're not going to talk. She was involved. Anyway, July 1st, Mammoth Cave is authorized by Congress. I just went to Mammoth Cave recently. It was really cool. October 23rd, Walt Disney released Dumbo, which was one of my favorite movies as a kid.
Never watched it.
Moving on. December 7th was the attack on Pearl Harbor, which you'll notice was the day after Richard was born.
So he just, like, came into the world and, like, stuff already started happening. It was like, it was a no-go.
He was the harbinger. That is, yes, exactly correct. So back to what I was saying earlier about his home life, or maybe not because we stopped recording. According to the 1940 census, Frank lived with his family in Norwood, Mercer County, Illinois at 6113. He rented a room for him and his wife and all 8 of their children for $6 a month, which is approximately $127 a month today. So, yeah, the median rent in Illinois in 1940 was $33 or $612. So they were well below the poverty line. They were not living well.
I wish rent was $600.
I wish rent was $6.
I would not live anywhere with a rent of $6. It's a trap. You're trying to trap me. I'm not signing a contract.
Seriously. Yeah. So, like I said earlier, Frank got a new job at Western Stoneware Company, and so the family moved to Monmouth, Illinois. And then when Speck was only 6 years old, his father died, and they were very close. By all accounts, Frank was a good father to Richard and to all of his children. So, unfortunately, Mary meets this fella named Carl August Rudolph Lindbergh, who is a traveling insurance salesman from Texas, and he's on a train trip to Chicago, and that's where he meets Mary, Carl is a bad dude. He's got a bad criminal history. He is a notorious drunk. And so Mary is like, Carl, I'm gonna marry you. And so they get married on May 10th, 1950 in Palo Pinto, Texas. And Dick Speck becomes Dick Lindbergh. So Dick and his younger sister stayed for a little while in Illinois with their older sister, Sarah. So okay. At this point, Dick and his younger sister are pretty much the only ones that are still relying on Mary. So they stayed behind to finish the school year. And when Dick was done with second grade, they moved to Santo, Texas with their mother and stepfather.
So Dick and his little sister were the only two that were depending on the mother. So like all the other siblings were like old and like they had their own stuff going on.
Right. Like Sarah was married. So they stayed with Sarah and her husband for just a little while before moving to Texas. So this next little section. Okay. So I got a lot of my information from murderpedia.org and I found like other sources, credible sources that, what's the word? Validated that information. So this was one thing that I found on Murderpedia that I wasn't really able to find anywhere else, really. Dick began drinking at the age of 12. And by 15, he was drinking every day.
Why was he drinking? Do we know why he was drinking?
I don't know why he was drinking, but he did. I mean, his stepfather was abusive and a drunk, so... So another alleged thing during his middle school years is that he refused to wear his glasses, which I don't really understand. I mean,
I feel like the only person you're hurting is yourself. He just honestly wanted
the only person. Exactly. Well, it's like the ultimate. He can't accept the truth. Like he can't accept the world for the way it is, and he like obviously has a problem with insecurity and. I don't know. I think it's a psychological thing.
Do you think he was born that way or he was created that way?
I think that this man was born a dick. And he was put in the right set of circumstances to grow up to become a really, really huge dick.
I mean, when your name is Richard.
Yeah, he was born. He was destined.
It was
in the cards. Exactly. So... Back to eighth grade, Dick repeated the eighth grade at J.L. Long Junior High, in part because he refused to recite in class because of a lifelong fear of people staring at him. Again, insecurity. So on to his high school years. In 1957, Dick started ninth grade at Crozier Technical High School, and he failed every subject and did not return for the spring semester.
Did his mother know he was like failing every class?
I mean, at this point, he had already had run-ins with the law, so I feel like she just, like, really didn't, like, knew that he was, like a runt, you know? Like, he was going to end up not going anywhere with his life, and she was like, oh, well, I have, like, all these other kids, so...
Okay. But, like, I feel like the other kids are, like, grown, and, like, are like, his brothers doing things that are like, bad? Like,
no,
are his brothers having...
No.
Run-ins with the law, sisters?
No, I mean, all of them didn't really live very long, as far as I can tell, but they were all successful, and, like, most of them were married.
Okay.
So, he was pretty much the only one, as far as I could tell, that was just not...
He was the runt.
He was the runt, and I mean, he didn't have a good run of it, either. He had a really bad... I mean, he grew up very poor, and then he went from losing his father to having an abusive stepfather... So it's a pretty clear trajectory. And later on, I think I'm going to mention this later. This is another thing that I didn't find much information in a lot of sources, but one source said that he may have suffered a brain injury as a child, which
he
is very
dropped
common
on his
in
head.
These cases, in some way or another, you know, like maybe he like fell off a swing or something. That's what it usually is.
Still, what were his parents doing as to like, I mean, I guess kids just bump their heads.
I guess. I don't know. Anyway, on to his adult life. His first arrest was in 1955 at 13 years old. He was arrested for trespassing, and what followed was a series of misdemeanors. I don't have too much evidence. I'd, I mean, I don't have too much information on these misdemeanors because I wasn't able to find very many of the official records for them. Not really sure what that's about, but we'll get into a little bit more of that later. So in 1960, he went to work for the company 7-Up, and he worked there for 3 years as a laborer, putting 7-Up in the bottles and putting the bottles in the boxes and putting the boxes in the truck and all that.
Was he driving the truck too? Maybe it was
Mm,
1960 something.
probably. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. And he's obviously drunk because he's been drinking every day since he was 15, so.
Way to go, Dick.
Way to go, Dick. So, 1960, he's 18 at this point. 1961, he meets Shirley Annette Malone at the Texas State Fair in October, and Shirley becomes pregnant 3 weeks after dating him. So
I feel
the
like that's a
two
little bit too
married,
fast.
it is quite fast, and the two get married only a couple months later, January 19th, 1962, and Shirley moves in with the Speck family, including Mary, sans Farrell, who moved back to California, goodbye and God bless,
Good riddance.
and Dick's younger sister, who is now married, so her husband is living with them as well.
That is a house full, and they probably have like one bathroom.
I can't imagine he's ever lived anywhere other than with all these people, I don't know. He's never had any kind of privacy. I don't know. But at this point, he goes back to using his birth name, which is Richard Franklin Speck. And on July 5th, 1962, his daughter with Shirley was born, who will remain nameless. And Dick was not present at the birth because he was serving a 22-day jail sentence for disturbing the peace in McKinney, Texas, after a drunk fight.
I feel like missing the birth of your child is like dang. Like, what were you doing that you missed the birth of your child?
Yeah, this guy clearly did not care at all. He
Poor Ma
just.
What's his wife's name? Mary?
Shirley.
Shirley. Oh, I can
Yeah,
remember that one
poor
easy.
Shirley. Yeah, Shirley. Okay, so things start to just escalate from here. On July 19th, 60, in July 1963, Speck is arrested at 21 years old and convicted of forgery and burglary after forging a co-worker's paycheck and stealing cigs and beer and $3 from a grocery store. He was sentenced to 3 years in the Texas State Penitentiary and was paroled on January 2nd, 1965, after serving for 16 months.
Okay.
So, 16 months, he stole $3 and some beer and some cigs, and he forged a check. I mean,
I mean, exactly. I mean, yeah, you served 16 months. I mean, you did steal, but I mean,
so it gets worse.
perfect.
at 2:20 a.m., January 9th, 1965, 1 week after Dick was paroled, he attacks a woman with a 17-inch carving knife in the parking lot of her apartment building. He flees when the woman started screaming and is apprehended by police only a few blocks away. He's convicted of aggravated assault and was given a 16-month sentence to run concurrently with a parole violation sentence and return to prison in Huntsville. But due to an error, was released from prison just 6 months later on completion of his parole violation sentence on July 2nd, 1965.
So he was going to get 16 months for basically trying to kill a woman with a
So
17-inch knife.
they added 16 months. Yes, basically they added 16 months to his parole violation sentence for attacking this woman with a 17-inch knife.
That's a lot of inches.
And then someone screwed up and he served for 6 months. 6 months.
Lucky
Anyways,
bastard.
l anyways, After being released, he worked as a driver for a meat company and had 6 driving accidents before later being fired for not coming to work. Again, he's a worthless drunk and an idiot. So
he got fired for not coming to work, but like not for like fucking but up on the job.
Not for the 6 driving accidents, apparently. Yeah. I need some more wine. Hold on. That's good wine. So in December 1965... after taking advice from his mother, Dick moves in with a 29-year-old woman who was his favorite bartender at his favorite bar. I think I took her name out too, either that or it wasn't even mentioned. The bar was called Jenny's Lounge, and the woman needed someone to babysit her 3 children, and Dick just seemed like the perfect drunk for the job. So at this point, he and Shirley had been separated because, remember, he went to jail and he was, you know, being a crazy asshole. And she filed for divorce in January of 1966. So 1966 is where we will be for the next little while.
So how long were they married?
Just to keep that in mind. Let me see. Shirley married Dick on January 19th, 1962. So 1962 to
1966.
Yeah, so that's only 4 years.
That's a whole degree.
But he was in jail. I mean, I would have
for
done
16
the same
months,
thing.
At least 16 months of it.
And I mean, for all this stuff that, and then he attacked that woman, remember?
I do remember. I can't forget.
So, I mean, so maybe after like the first part, she was like, okay, well, he's just trying to like support the family and he's not doing it well, but at least he's doing something. And then it was like, oh no, he's crazy. I gotta get out of here. So she does. She divorces him in January 1966. And the same month, Dick stabs a man in a knife fight at Jenny's Lounge, and he was charged with aggravated assault. However, his mother, Mary, good old Mary, hired an attorney who was able to get the charge reduced to disturbing the peace. He was fined $10, which would be about $91.50 today, and he refused to pay it, so he was jailed for 3 days.
So this is the second time where he's, like, tried to kill someone. And mm-hmm. They're just like, okay, we're going to stick you in jail for a little bit. Just kidding.
Mm-hmm. 3 days. He was fined $10 for trying to stab somebody.
You know how much a parking ticket is now for parking by a fire hydrant?
See, oh my gosh. Insane. Oh my gosh.
I didn't know you couldn't park by fire hydrants.
That's so crazy. So crazy. Okay.
But $10 in 1966.
Oh my gosh. It's insane. So on March 5th, 1966, Dick bought a car. And the next evening, he stole 70 cartons of cigarettes and sold them in the parking lot of the grocery store that he stole them from before abandoning the car. The police traced the car to him and issued a warrant for his arrest on March 8th. This would be his 42nd arrest in Dallas. So he's been arrested 41 times, but 42 was 42 too many. So he was like, I gotta get out of here. So he goes back home and his younger sister drives him to the bus stop and he hops on a bus and he goes to Chicago.
Good old Chicago.
Good old Chicago. So of course that's Illinois. It's his home state. And his sister Martha, who is now Martha Thornton, lives in Chicago with her husband and her 2 kids. And so he stays a couple nights with Martha, and then he goes back to Monmouth, which is where he's from, and he stays with some friends there, and his brother, Howie, who's a carpenter, and Howie finds a job for Dick sanding plasterboard. So at this point in the story, it's Murderpedia says that Dick was mad at Cheryl, who had moved on 2 days after their divorce.
Shirley?
Which... oh, shit. Yeah, you're right. Stop it. It's so... Dick was mad that Shirley, a boss bitch, had moved on 2 days after their divorce. Remember that they got separated because he fucking went to prison and tried to stab a woman in a parking lot. So, obviously she was ready to move on because Absolutely. He was in prison. Yeah. I mean, he'd been in prison for so long, and she like waited to divorce him too, like after he got out of prison. So he's just, again, he's insecure. On March 25th, again, 1966, Dick moves into the Christie Hotel and spends his time drinking around town before being detained after reportedly threatening a man in a tavern restroom with his knife.
Ooh, I'm sensing a pattern here.
Yes, it's very bad. It's not good.
Leave it to Dick.
Leave it to Dick. So here's where things get worse again. Oh, so Miss Virgil Harris is one of the first victims, at least in my eyes, of Dick. And there's a trigger warning here for sexual assault. On April 3rd, 1966, Miss Harris, 65, returned home at 1 a.m. to a burglar with a knife, described as a 6-foot-tall white man who was very polite and spoke very softly with a southern drawl. She was then blindfolded, tied up, raped, and her house was ransacked. So, Mary, the next victim in this little situation is Mary Kay Pierce. So on the 9th of April, Mary Kay Pierce, a 32-year-old bartender who worked at Frank's Place in downtown Monmouth, was seen leaving the bar at 12:45 a.m. She was reported missing on April 13th, and her body was found later that day in an empty hog house behind Frank's Place.
Oh, no.
Having died from a blow to her abdomen that ruptured her liver.
So when you say blow, do you mean like a punch?
Very, like, very bad. Very, yes. I mean, yes. So, yes. Very bad. So, I did a little research, fun fact again. The liver is especially a vulnerable organ because it can be injured by a punch of up to 5 meters per second, and the average man can punch 6 meters per second. Mm-hmm. So, when your liver gets hit, a little signal gets sent to something in your brain that I can't remember what it's called. And then your blood pressure goes down and your heart rate goes down. So you pass out because your body needs to send blood to the brain, and it literally is like, go prone, lie on the floor. So you pass out. But in this case, that's not really important because her liver literally exploded. So she did clearly did not live very long after her liver burst.
I thought you could live without your liver.
No, that's another thing. The liver is a vital organ. It is very important.
Yeah.
You cannot live without your liver, unfortunately. You cannot drink.
Can you live with half of it?
No, I think that what happens is that your liver can regrow. Don't quote me on this.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, so like if you've got a bum liver, then when you get a liver transplant, they take half of somebody else's liver, their liver grows back, and then you get the new, so it's like a starfish, you know. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense, but I do not like it. At all.
So, remember...
Well, he killed this woman by punching her in the stomach?
He killed this woman by punching her. And he more than likely knew that when he punched her in the stomach that that was going to happen.
What a way to go.
Yeah, so this guy's Dick. Dick, remember I said earlier his brother, Howie, got him a job as a carpenter... person.
Yeah.
So he actually helped build the hog house behind Frank's Place. So he came to Frank's Place to pick up his check on April 15th, 4 days. I'm sorry, 6 days after he murdered Mary Kay.
He just left her in the hog pen?
Mm-hmm. He was briefly questioned by the police who were investigating her death. And he was asked not to leave town. So on the 19th, they went to the Christie Hotel to look for him and ask him some more questions, and they found that he had left a few hours earlier.
Who, Dick?
Dick, yes. They asked him to stay so they could question him more, and he left, obviously, because he
fled.
Did it. Like,
out of the country.
Yeah, I mean...
Mexico.
If you what do you think is going to happen?
In Texas.
You ask someone that knows that they're guilty not to leave town, like, what did you think was going to happen? I'm... I'm astounded. Anyways, they searched his room at the Christie Hotel, and they turned up multiple items that had been reportedly stolen, including a radio and costume jewelry from Miss Harris's house. So remember Miss Harris earlier?
The first old lady?
The first older, yeah. The second one was 32. But yes, Miss Harris was 65, and she was brutally assaulted. So that was, yeah.
That's the beginning of old age.
So obviously there's evidence here. I mean, he's never convicted of these murders, but there's evidence. I'm sorry, Mary Kate, Miss Harris was not murdered, but he was never convicted of her assault or of Mary Kay's murder. But there's obvious evidence here that he most likely committed these murders.
Sips wine.
Oh, I'm going to need a refill in a few minutes. So now he's murdered, more than likely, he's murdered his first victim. So there's a little brief intermission, or possibly a planning period, where...
Cooling off period.
I don't know. So here's why I say that. Technically, he is not a serial killer. And you'll see why a little bit later, but this is not a long cooling off period. I think that you have to have like a little bit longer for it to be considered a cooling off period. Anyway, on April 19th, 1966, that's the same day that he fled the Christie Hotel in Monmouth, he goes back to his sister's house with her husband, Jean Thornton, and their two children. He spins this wild, crazy story about having to leave Monmouth because he refused to sell narcotics for a crime syndicate there in Illinois.
First, what is a syndicate?
Obviously, I don't know.
He was trying to sell drugs for someone.
He was not. He was,
well, in his mind, he was.
Yeah, he's just manipulating, like, even the
he's
people
just
that
dick.
Even the people, he's just a dick, and he's manipulating the people that care about him. So a few days later, Gene takes Dick to apply for the U.S. Coast Guard. And there he finds work immediately after his examination and joins the crew of Inland Steel's Clarence B. Randall on April 30th. So that sounds a little bit confusing. He got on a ship. He is now in the U.S. Coast Guard.
Unfortunate for the U.S. Coast Guard.
Yeah, but then again, I don't want him here.
Absolutely.
Put him on a ship and get him out of the
Put him on a
here.
Boat.
If you don't want to put him on a boat. So on May 3rd, 1966, he leaves on the boat with the Coast Guard. On May 3rd, 1966, Dick leaves the Coast Guard with a case of appendicitis. He was airlifted from the ship to St. Joseph's Hospital in Hanek, Michigan, where he had an appendectomy. After recovering with Martha, he returned to the ship on May 20th until June 14th, when he got in a spat with an officer and was put ashore the following day.
So he can't even be out, like, out to sea.
Yeah, they don't even want him on the boat. They're like,
they don't want him in the ocean.
Yeah, they're like, get out of here. This is the only other piece of information that I couldn't really find anywhere else in any other sources. But according to Murderpedia, the following week, Speck stayed at the St. Elmo an East Side Chicago flop house at East 99th Street and South Ewing Avenue. Speck then traveled by train to Houghton, Michigan, staying at the Douglas House to visit Judy Leakanyemi, a 28-year-old nurse's aide going through a divorce whom he had befriended at St. Joseph's Hospital. And afterwards, on June 27th, 1966, Judy gave him $80, which is about $731.50 in today's money, to help him until he found work. So, first of
this
all,
was
that
a
is
good
a
friend.
Lot of money. That is a good friend. That is a lot of money. Wow. Also, this person never gets mentioned again in the story. So, I don't, like, it's like he just saw this woman at the hospital that he was just at, and he was like, I'm going to go visit her in Michigan for a week. And I mean, maybe he just wanted money. And in my mind, I was like, maybe he saw her at the hospital and he was like, I'm gonna murder her, you know, or like I'm gonna assault her. And so he was like, I'm gonna go to her house. But then again, like, how did he, obviously they knew each other if he had her address. You know, he went to her house. So maybe they were friends.
Maybe he was stalking her.
Maybe he was stalking her. Who knows? I mean, he knows, but
Dick does.
Dick knows. So on June 27th, 1966, after leaving Judy, Speck goes again to stay with his sister, Martha, and her family in Chicago for the next 2 weeks. And on the 30th, Gene, classic Gene, drove Dick to the National Maritime Union hiring hall to file for a Seaman's card. Classic Dick.
Seaman's card, classic Dick.
And then on the 8th of July of 1966, Gene takes Dick to pick up his Seaman's card, classic Dick, but he did not get approved because they gave the job to a more experienced Seaman.
I mean, I would, honestly. I'm never going to hold you.
Obviously, he had more Seaman experience than Dick, so what can you do with that?
What can you do?
So this is where things start to pick up just a little bit. I'm going to go get some more wine. Okay, I'm back. We're back. I'm back now. I'm recording. Are you here? We are here. I have a more full glass of wine, and I'm ready to get back at. I'm ready to get back at it. Okay, back to where we were. July 8th, 1966. This is Friday. Gene takes Dick to pick up his Seaman's card. Classic Dick. But he did not get approved because they gave the job to a more experienced seaman, a seaman with more experience than Dick. On Monday, July 11th, Speck has officially outstayed his welcome with Martha and Gene. And Gene takes him back to the hiring hall, and he stays the night at Pauline's rooming house, which was a mile away in the Vets Park neighborhood of South Deering, Chicago.
I have literally heard nothing positive about his life so far.
Yeah.
Except for the fact that, like, pretty bad. He kind of liked his father, but, like, then again, he died when he was, like, what, 6 years old?
It's pretty bad. It gets pretty worse. So, the next day, Tuesday, July 12th, 1966, Dick returns to the hiring hall and receives an assignment on Sinclair Oil's tanker SS Sinclair Great Lakes. He was driven there and found that his spot had been taken again by another seaman. And he was driven back. Yes, rejection. Like over and over and over and over again. And now, I mean, like, they drove him back to Chicago, but he doesn't have any money. So he sleeps in an unfinished house after dropping off his bags at a gas station. And in the morning, on July 13th, he picks up his bags and he goes back to the hiring center. He meets Martha and Gene again. They chat. Martha gives him $25, and Dick leaves the hiring center at 10:30 a.m. on July 13th. So this is Wednesday.
Okay, this is Wednesday.
So Dick goes to check in at the Shipyard Inn. And then he goes bar hopping. Classic Dick.
Classic Dick.
So, unfortunately, another trigger warning here for sexual assault. Victim number 3, Ella Mae Hooper, 53 years old.
Oh, 53.
Yes, poor Ella Mae. 53-year-old Ella Mae was held at knife point and brought back to Speck's room, where he raped her and stole her black 22 ROM revolver. He then went to dinner at Kay's Pilot House. He returned back to the Shipyard Inn Tavern, and at 10:20 p.m., he left the Shipyard Inn dressed in black with a pocket knife, a hunting knife, and the 22 revolver that he had stolen from Ella Mae.
So, come on, Dick. Like, for real?
Yeah, so this is Dick. Yeah.
I just want to know the why behind all of this. Like, he's obviously, like, I don't know. Like stabbing. I just feel like stabbing is just like a very brutal way.
Right. He's got violent tendencies. He's got some aggression. We already talked about, I mean, his stepfather, but by all accounts, his mother and his biological father were good parents. And then there was the whole head injury thing, but
he was definitely dropped.
He had to have been dropped.
Absolutely. Because, that's a dropped baby.
That's a dropped baby. So this is where things just get really horrible. I am going to go back and forth now between quoting the Richard Speck Born to Raise Hell by Connie Filippelli, which I started quoting in the very beginning. I'll be careful to try and let you know when I'm doing that. So let's get into it.
I love a good quote.
At 11 p.m. on July 13th, 1966, Speck allegedly followed a nurse who turned out to be Patricia Matsuke. After following her home, he breaks into her townhouse at 2319 East 100th Street by sliding open a window. The townhouse was being used to house 8 nursing residents of South Chicago Community Hospital. He quietly climbed the stairs and approached the door of Cora Amural. So, this next part is a quote. It's actually not from the Born to Raise Hell that I was mentioning. This is actually straight from Cora's testimony, but I'm bringing it in here now because this is what transpired next. So this is a straight, this is a quote that I took from the Born to Raise Hell, which is paraphrasing Cora's testimony in the official court, in the official trial.
So she survived.
So Cora survived. Yes, okay. Spoiler alert. So, quote, Cora heard 4 knocks on the door. Opening it, she saw Speck, very tall, dressed in black, standing in the doorway, a small revolver in his hand. The bedroom light illuminated his blonde hair. Cora stared at the gun. Speck pushed her back. Where are your companions? Speck asked and grabbed her arm. By that time, Merlita had gotten out of bed. Speck walked both women down the hall to the large bedroom in the back. Flicking on the light, he saw 3 women sleeping. Cora, Merlita, and Valentina hid in a closet, frightened. Then, when one of the women knocked on the closet door and assured her roommates the man would not harm them, they came out. Speck pointed the gun at Nina and Pat while holding Pamela around the waist. He switched off the light and made the women sit in a semicircle, their backs to the window. Speck sat facing them, smiling. His long legs and slow Texas drawl made him seem like a buddy, someone close to their age. I want some money. I'm going to New Orleans. Each asked permission to get their purses and gave Speck all their money. After a while, so let me stop here just to recap. So we've got Cora, we've got Merlita, and we've got Valentina. And then we've got, yeah.
What state is he in?
We are in Chicago.
We're still in Chicago, okay.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So we've got Cora, Merlita, and Valentina, who go to hide in the closet. And then we've got Nina and Pat and Pamela. And eventually he gets them out of the closet, and so they're all sitting in a semicircle in one of the bedrooms. And then, after a while, Gloria Davey came home from a date with her boyfriend. She staggered up the stairs somewhat drunk and opened the door to the bedroom. She screamed a low guttural scream when she saw Speck with a gun. Gloria joined the circle. Speck got up, tore a sheet from one of the bunk beds, and began cutting them into strips. One by one, he tied each woman's hand and feet. 2 other nurses, Mary Ann and Suzanne, back from a chat session, opened the door to the back bedroom and found Speck hovering over a bound and gagged Pamela, her eyes filled with terror. So, we've got 7 of the girls sitting in a circle in the bedroom, and then 2 other people, Mary Ann and Suzanne, come home, and they see Speck standing over the woman who are tied. So they bolted down the hall right into the big room and screamed when they saw the other women tied up. Speck, in hot pursuit behind them, pushed them into another bedroom. He stabbed and strangled the two women as they fought back. Then he washed up and returned to Pamela to finish her off with one stab to her heart. He washed again. In the bedroom, the girls tried to squeeze themselves under the narrow bunk beds. Speck untied Nina's feet, led her down the hall to a bedroom, stabbed her in the neck, and suffocated her with a pillow. Cora heard her say, "Ah," and then the sound of water. Cora struggled even more to get her head under the bunk. Speck appeared and took Valentina, not bothering to untie her feet. He easily lifted the 100-pound woman and carried her to her death. Cora heard "ah" again and the sound of water. He returned for Merlita, lifting her and carrying her off. 5 minutes passed. Cora heard her say, "Masakit, it hurts." Another 30 minutes passed and the water sounds. Before he took Pat Matusik, an athletic 155-pound woman, Cora heard him ask, "Are you the girl in the yellow dress?" He led Pat to the bathroom, punched her in the stomach, rupturing her liver, and then strangled her. Speck came back to the room, disrobed Gloria, who was asleep from the drinking she had done that evening, and raped her. As the bed springs squeaked and groaned, Cora watched, then closed her eyes and prayed. When she opened them again, they were gone. Cora decided to switch beds. She rolled and scooted her way across the bedroom floor, knowing that any moment Speck could come in and drag her to her death. She made it under the bed and wedged herself in as tight against the wall as possible and waited. End quote.
Ah! That was so heavy.
So yeah, that was really bad. I didn't want to stop in the middle of it, but I know it's a lot of information. It's really, just really, 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 really bad.
I stopped. I mean, I just feel like he escalated so quickly.
I know
he stabbed like a guy in a bar. He like punched an old lady. He killed another lady. But I feel like to take on a whole house of women and just like kill them off one by one by one.
Just insane. Absolutely. So flashback to the beginning of the story when I read Cora, the sound that Judy heard, Judy Dykton, she heard Cora screaming. She waited underneath the bunk bed until about 6 a.m. and then she got out on the window stoop and she screamed. Judy Dykton hears Cora and she goes over to the townhouse. She finds Gloria in the first floor living room. And she goes over to her and she knows that she's dead. And so she runs out and she alerts the house mother, Miss Bisson. And Miss Bisson and another girl, Leona, they go over to the house. Cora apparently jumped from the 10-foot ledge, stood on the front stairs and said, "Everyone on the sampan has been killed." And she told them not to go in because she thought that the killer could still be in there. Leona goes in anyway, and she finds all of the bodies, and she's obviously horrified. Miss Bisson calls the South Chicago Community Hospital while someone flags down Officer Daniel Kelly, who is a young patrolman with very little experience. So, yeah. Officer Daniel Kelly was the first one to actually, the first officer to discover the bodies, and he is absolutely horrified. He goes outside and he starts throwing up. And another man, Joe Cummings, who is a radio police reporter, not an officer, a reporter, he comes and he goes in as well. And like I said, he's not a police officer. He's just a reporter. And he's like, "Hey, I'm going to go inside and I'm not going to touch anything." And Officer Kelly is like, "All right, whatever." He's too busy blowing chunks. So Joe Cummings goes inside and he's like, "What are you talking? Like, what's the problem? There's like a girl and she's dead in the living room. So what's the problem?" And Daniel Kelly's like, "Go upstairs." So Joe Cummings, he goes upstairs and he comes back outside and he starts throwing up as well.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's not good. Police arrive and they do essentially the same thing. They're like, "Why is everyone freaking out?" And then they go inside and they're like, Whoa. So the first detective on the scene is Jack Walenda, who comes in at 6:30 a.m. Like I said before, Cora comes out of hiding around 6. So this is all happening really fast. The first detect like these are these other guys have already seen what happened, and these other guys, the detectives show up 30 minutes after Cora comes out of hiding. So I'm now going to quote the scene again from Born to Raise Hell by Connie Filippelli. This is the scene according to Jack Walenda's perspective, and there's another trigger warning here for graphic content. It is very graphic. It is gnarly.
I feel like if you're
So,
listening to our podcast, that just has to be a gnarly warning in itself.
yeah. So this is gonna be pretty bad. You ready to get bummed out?
Sure.
I'm gonna drink some wine.
I'm gonna drink some wine too.
Okay. Quote. First, Gloria Davey, nude, belly down on the couch, a strip of sheet tied with double knots, knots that looked too perfect, too professional. He noticed what appeared to be semen between her buttocks. Buttons from her blouse were strewn all over the stairs. The killer had torn them off her while walking her down the stairs. Tossed on the floor, white BVD t-shirt was found. Walenda checked the upstairs bedroom and found the body of Pamela Wilkening, gagged, stabbed through the heart. Near her, Suzanne Ferris, lying face down in a pool of blood, a white nurse's stocking tied around her neck. Walenda counted 18 stab wounds to her chest and neck. Next, Mary Ann Jordan, Suzanne's close friend, lay on her back, stabbed 3 times in the chest, once in the neck, and eye. He moved on to the northwest bedroom where he found Nina Schmale, her nightgown hoisted to her breasts, the same strips of sheet tied around her neck with the two characteristic knots. Stab wounds formed a ritualistic pattern, although superficial, around her neck. At closer examination, her neck appeared to be broken. Under a blue cover, he found Valentina Pezon, 24, face down, her throat cut, bisecting her voice box. Thrown over her like a broken doll lay Merlita Gargulo, body face up, stabbed and strangled. Walenda walked through the door to the right. The legs of Patricia Matusik protruded from the bathroom. On her back, hands bound behind her, strangled with a piece of bedsheet, double knotted, her nightgown rolled up over her breasts, her white panties rolled down. It looked like she was kicked in the stomach. Bloody towels all over the bathroom floor. Although an experienced detective, Walenda knew this was the worst crime he had ever seen. End quote. Oh, so that was just horrible. That was so horrible. I'm sweating. Oh my God, I'm
So,
sweating. It
like,
was eight.
I'm just
Eight
confused as to
girls.
like
Oh.
how he was able to like how he was able to kill like what is it, six girls?
Yeah, I've heard that opinion before.
Eight.
And you
How
might be
like
right. Like if it was
I
depending on the
feel like they could have
situation, of
like
course, if
overpowered him.
someone else was there when it happened or whatnot, if someone could have helped them rally together against him, then I think that they definitely could have overpowered him. But being in that kind of situation, they were like, oh, like he's got weapons on him. He's got a gun. He's got two knives, and he's just like. He came in and he acted like a gentleman. He comes
But
in
he
and
was
he's like,
literally just picking them
"Howdy, folks.
off,
I'm
like one
Dick
by one.
Speck. I'm here for your money. Give it to me now." And they're like, "Okay, Dick." Obviously, they were terrified, but they were gonna just give him their money. You know, they were like, "Oh, this dude. I mean, he's just a burglar." They didn't think they were in danger. And then
End
all of a
quote.
sudden, he starts stabbing them and picking them off one by one. It's just absolutely the most crazy escalation.
And so, like, I feel like where is this anger towards women coming from? You know, I want to know where this is coming from.
Mm-hmm. I mean, remember, all of this started in January 1966, when Shirley divorced Richard.
But then again, you were also a shit human to Shirley, so...
Exactly. And it's not like, I mean, he was trying to assault other women, so he wasn't even being faithful. So, like, again, it's this, like, insecurity and superiority. He thinks that he's better, and he thinks he can do whatever he wants, and he obviously doesn't have any respect for human life, and he's a piece of garbage. So, next, the bodies were released to the Cook Coroner County... Blah, blah, blah. The bodies were released to the Cook County coroner, Andrew Toman, and the house was sealed. Again, this happened really fast, so I gotta say, this is pretty good work right here, just, like, sealing up the house and getting the bodies out really quickly. Of course, like, two or three people have already walked through the crime scene, but they got it sealed up really quickly, and they got the evidence that they needed, which is what really matters.
Okay. And what time did Dick come into the house?
Dick entered the house at 11 p.m. and he likely left around 12:30 a.m.
So he did this all within like a matter of an hour and a half.
Yeah, about an hour and a half. Yeah.
That is so scary.
Yeah, and of course Cora didn't know if he was still there, so she stayed hidden until 6 a.m.
I know, poor Cora.
So immediately, a manhunt ensues, and with a description from Cora of the killer, a 6 feet tall, blonde hair, 106-pound man with a southern drawl.
106 pounds?
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I say 106? 160.
Oh, I'm about to say, girl, I know you could have hit Dick.
No, yeah, he was 160 pounds. I'm sorry, I'm on my second glass. So... Here we go. Quote, Speck arrived at Pete's tap room around 10:30 a.m., fresh, clean, and rested. Wait one second. This must be July 14th. So I should say that. All of this happened on July 13th, so the bodies were found on the morning of July 14th. So, on the morning of July 14th, quote, Speck arrived at Pete's tap room around 10:30 a.m., fresh, clean, and rested. Side note, I don't know if you noticed this, he washed up every time after he murdered, like after every murder,
yeah,
he washed his hands. And Cora says that she hears the water. And so that's led a lot of people to believe that he had oppressive compulsive disorder or OCD tendencies, which could have been the case. Yeah, I mean, again, this doesn't seem very well planned out. And he's pretty stupid. He's got an eighth grade education. So he's probably like, oh, maybe if I wash my hands between every murder, then there'll be less evidence.
Did he even wear a mask?
No. So, fresh, clean, and rested. From his belt hung a 12-inch hunting knife, not the knife used in the killing. Speck didn't feel a bit anxious showing it off. A month earlier, Speck pawned his 25-jewel watch for some booze. Now, with a few bucks on him, he bought the watch back from Ray Crawford, the bartender. Then he asked Crawford to put the hunting knife behind the bar. Comfortable, Speck began to spin a tall tale about his time in Vietnam, how he used the knife to kill several people there. A lie. Speck, at one point, reached behind the bar, got the knife, then sneaked behind the bartender, put his left arm around his chest, and held the knife at his throat. He told Crawford, "This is the way he'd kill someone if he had to." Crawford, angry and not impressed, read him the riot act. Speck, with his southern charm, claimed it was just a big joke. William Kirkland, a regular at the bar, bought the knife from Speck, probably because he knew he was a sociopath. He told Kirkland he purchased the knife from a vet aboard ship. In reality, the knife was given to Speck from his brother-in-law, Gene Thornton, classic Gene. The drunk duo traipsed across the street to another bar, the SoCo Grad, and continued to drink. It was there that Speck, for the first time, heard that there was a survivor from the massacre.
What?
Turning Right. Turning to Kirkland, he said, "It must have been some dirty motherfucker that done it." Wait. "It must have been some dirty motherfucker that done it."
Ew, then don't do that. Like, literally never again.
I'm sorry. Then he started on another tale of how he hit his brother-in-law over the head with a bottle and was thrown out of the house, but not before his sister gave him $85. So now we know the real reason that he was thrown out of Martha's house, because he hit Gene on the head with a bottle.
Or maybe that but was then a again, lie.
Then again, exactly. You he's can't really trust a single thing that this guy says, because he's just said four lies in the same breath, you know? So, I don't know.
He obviously can't count either.
So Speck meets up with another drinking buddy who goes by Red. He tells him that last night he was bumping uglies with a hooker and he got it for free because it was so good, which is obviously a lie because, as we know, he was raping Ella Mae Hooper the night before. So Red doesn't really give a fuck. He passes out in the ship in Speck's room in the Shipyard Inn. One of the officers looking for Dick called Gene to let him know that the Union Hall had found a job for him. Okay, so that all happened a little fast. So Speck is drinking with Red. Red passes out in the inn, in Speck's room. Speck goes back downstairs to have a drink. Meanwhile, the officers who were looking for Speck call his stepbrother Gene. And they're like, "We got a job for Dick." And Gene is like, "Great. I've been trying to get this dude a job for a long time." He doesn't know it's a trap. So Gene calls Dick, and I'm going to go back into the quote here. So, quote, "Thornton called the Shipyard Inn where he found Speck. He told Speck to call the Union Hall because they had a job for him. Speck called the Union Hall, and the agent told him to come down for his assignment on the ship, Sinclair Great Lakes, the same ship that earlier had already sailed off, remember?" So clever Speck somehow used his last brain cell and knew that the Sinclair had already shipped out. So he told the agent that he was up north and that it would take an hour to get there, but that he'd be down to pick up the assignment ASAP. Obviously, he never showed up. Immediately, Speck went upstairs. He woke up Red, told him to pack his bags. He brought Red downstairs, put him on the curb, and he went into the Shipyard Inn and started playing pool by himself. Quote, "Three plain-clothed cops came in looking for a tall, blonde guy with a southern accent. Speck played cool. He listened and continued to play pool, just 10 feet from the officers. The bartender was no help. So, when the cabbie arrived, Speck slipped out of the side door, and he got in the cab with Red. He told the cab to drop Red off at home, Rose before Hose, and then he asked the cab to drop him off at the Raleigh Hotel. The account of this was kind of interesting. The cabbie was like, yeah, this guy seemed really out of it. He was asking me to go north, but he wasn't really telling me, like, which way to go. And I was just like, just tell me the address, man. That's verbatim. And so Speck was like, he like pointed like in a direction. He was like, drop me off over there. And it was the Raleigh Hotel. So Speck, you know, chaotic. He just goes in. He goes into the hotel.
So he's evaded capture.
Again, he three police officers walked in. He was playing pool by himself.
That's not suspicious at all.
And they go up to the bartender and they're like, hey, we're looking for a tall man with blonde hair. Have you seen him? And the bartender's like, nah, bro. And meanwhile, he's playing pool.
There's literally by a blonde himself man with blonde
right behind them. Wait, and then
a blonde man with blue eyes who's tall. All they had to do is have one conversation with him and be like, "Oh yeah, you're the guy."
Oh wait, Sagittarius, Gemini, is this me? So, so the cabbie comes inside. The cabbie comes inside and he's like, "Hey, cabbie here." Dick leaves. And the cops just don't know any better. And so he gets in the cabbie, like I said, he talks to him, he's like, take me there. So, quote, "At the Raleigh Hotel, Algy Lemhart, a clerk, remembered a drunken speck and his white trash accent coming in with a girl, redacted some outdated language right there, quote, giving him the wrong room number. He remembered he did not want to wake his boss, Miss Hulinger, so he let Speck go up. He watched the couple, and before the elevator closed, he heard the girl call him Richard. A half hour later, the girl came down and told the clerk that Speck had a gun. In the morning, Lemhart told Hulinger about the man with the gun. From the description, Hulinger figured it was Staten? I don't know what that means. Staten. Anyway, suspicious and perturbed, she called the police to sort it out. Two officers showed up at 8:30 a.m. from the 18th District Police Station a few blocks away. Speck, groggy from booze, woke up to see the two cops standing over him. He lay fully clothed on his bed with a gun sticking out from the pillow. The cops asked Speck why he had a gun. He denied it and told him it belonged to the hooker. When asked what his name was, he told them, Richard Speck. The police checked his wallet and found his Siemens ID, classic dick, and passport. Nothing connected yet. Not all the police were alerted to the identity of the killer. For what? 15 minutes, Speck was questioned. The officers confiscated the gun and left. However, they did not report the gun. Cops told the clerk Speck was harmless.
And what? After he's just murdered 8 women?
Speck was laying in bed. This is July 15th, by the way, 1966. And the policemen come in and they see him laying in the bed with a gun sticking out from underneath his pillow. And they're like, oh, this guy's harmless. They ask him some questions and then he's like, oh, this gun belongs to a hooker. And they leave. It's like, what? They have no idea that they're looking for a...
But he's harmless.
But then again, like, they're... I mean, it's the same city. And at this point, it's been a couple of days. They know that there was a murder. And they know that they're looking for a blonde man with a southern accent. How is he getting away with this?
Dare I say, a blonde man with blue eyes is, like, I feel like very common.
I guess so.
You have blonde hair?
I do have blonde hair.
You have blue eyes?
Yeah.
See, my point is proven.
So I just feel like everybody.
And you're also tall, so like, are you dick? Is this story about you, Justin?
I am not dick.
I just feel like, okay. I mean... Description is what? White man? That's the half the population of America.
That's half the... Okay, I'm more than that. Oh my gosh. Okay, so the cops told the clerk that Speck was harmless. And Speck is like, whoopee, I got away with it again. So, by the evening, Speck hits the bars again. And at this point, the Chicago police were asking the FBI to check on Speck's fingerprints. And later on, officers were dispatched at Cabrini Green near the Raleigh Hotel with rifles. And eventually they talked to good old Red, who told them, you know, what he went through with Dick and all that. Or I guess maybe he probably didn't even remember, to be honest with you.
Honestly.
Didn't find that. That wasn't in the court transcripts. So meanwhile, Speck meets up with a couple other fellas, Claude Lunsford, also known as One Eye, and Shorty Ingram.
One Eye and Shorty?
One Eye and Shorty. One Eye, Shorty, and Dick at the Star Hotel.
That is a That's comic right. book.
That's right. So, they drink, they have a good time, and then in the morning, Speck is like, getting all up. He's like, One Eye, come on, like, let's hop on a train, let's get out of here, let's leave. And One Eye's like, man, I just got here, like, I'm in Chicago, I'm gonna make some money, like, I'll hop on a train later. All right, So Speck won't give up, and One Eye is like, all right, peace, man. I'm gone. So he leaves. He's Speck alone. And Speck goes off. He starts to sell more of his stuff for money, for booze. And then on Saturday, July 19th, 1966, quote, homicide commander Flanagan, still on the streets all night looking for Speck, received a phone call on his car radio. Lieutenant Emil Geis, the police department's fingerprint expert, told Flanagan that Speck's prints were a match from the prints from the townhouse.
What?
The word spread fast. Officers were in tears. The frenzied search had wearied them both physically and spiritually. Now they hit pay dirt. Their hard work was paying off. Everyone knew Speck would be caught soon. So now they know it's Speck. And now they know Speck was seen at the hotel, because those officers are like, oh shit, we met Richard Speck in the hotel. And everybody's like, oh shit.
What is this? The LAPD?
Come on. What is this? The LAPD?
Come on.
Sponsor us, LAPD. So, please. As if they make any money. So, where was I? Hold on. I'm getting down to the bottom of my second glass now. So, once I get on my third, we're in some new territory.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, they're okay, yeah. So their hard work was paying off. Everyone knew Speck would be caught soon. End quote. So here, I'm going to give another trigger warning. I think it's the last trigger warning. This is for suicide. Mm-hmm. Quote, meanwhile, Speck had sold some of his belongings on Skid Row. Ready for another drunken binge, he picked up a pint of wine at the local liquor store and several newspapers with his name and photo splashed across them. Speck went back to the Star Hotel, sucked down the wine, slipped into the bathroom down the hall, smashed the bottle, and cut his wrist and inner elbow.
Oh no.
A blood trail led to a cubicle. Not Speck's cubicle, but his buddy One Eye. Oh. Still trying to hide his identity, he switched cubicles. I'm assuming that means he moved to One Eye's room. Because he still didn't want to get caught for some reason, even though he just tried to kill himself. So, back to the quote. Speck lay on his cot bleeding. Newspapers spread all over the floor. Guilty eyes staring up from his own photo. He called out to his neighbor for water and help. He was ignored. One Eye, doing the rounds after work, caught a glimpse of the newspapers with Speck's picture. He went back to the Star and found himself in the midst of Speck's suicide attempt. One Eye left, made an anonymous call to the police department saying that the man they are looking for is at the Star Hotel. Police did not dispatch a car.
What?
Pause for a surprise. So, Speck was rushed to Cook County Hospital after somebody found him, I guess, and the same hospital that had held the bodies of the nurses that were killed. Fun fact.
No.
It's not very fun. The ambulance drivers chatted about politics while Speck cried out for water. They never noticed the police bulletin on their dash with Speck's photo. Inside the emergency room, nurse Kathy O'Connor prepped Speck. Leroy Smith, a first resident, examined Speck's wounds. He noticed something familiar about him. He checked his arm and used his own saliva to wash off the blood, looking for a tattoo. It was there. As he suspected, born to raise hell. Smith asked the nurse to get the newspaper he left in another room. He compared the photo to Speck. Water, Speck pleaded. Smith grabbed him by the back of the neck, squeezing with all his might. Did you give water to the nurses? He dropped his head back on the gurney and called in a policeman who was guarding another patient down the hall. Smith told him he had Richard Speck, the suspect in the murders. Floored, the patrolman made the necessary calls and all hell broke loose. One thing was certain, Speck was going to get the best care possible. Bringing him to justice took priority over everything else. End quote.
Woo! I just feel like What can I say about that?
So finally, Leroy Smith, a young first-year resident, sees Spec, and he's like, oh, a blonde-haired dude. I'm going to see if he has any tattoos. He washes off the blood. Oh, he's got a tattoo. It says, born to raise hell. Oh, my God. This guy's a murderer. The only person who cared to check after all this time. I mean,
was a nurse.
What? No, this is Leroy Smith. He's a resident. He's
oh, a resident. I thought you meant like someone who was like in residence.
Well, it wasn't that specific. There are resident nurse, like resident nurses, but there was another nurse there. So I'm assuming that this is a resident to become a doctor, like a general doctor or whatever.
Really? Okay.
So, right, but again, he's like a student. He's like I would say like a master's, basically like a first year master's student in a hospital. So he discovers that this is Spec, and he calls for the police down the hall. Dick was, at this time, 24 years old.
Only 24? I feel like he's lived, like, 50 years. I feel like violence ages you.
Yeah.
24?
Yeah. 24 years old. So this next part is kind of weird. So the officers did not interview Dick for 3 weeks, supposedly because there were new rules due to the Miranda versus Arizona case, and they did not want to jeopardize his arrest. So here's where I'm going to input my opinion. It seems like the ops really shat the bed on this one, because more information and like, I don't know, like, clearly at the beginning, they didn't do what they were supposed to do. Like, there were
absolutely
so many errors. There were so many times where he could have been kept away from the general public, and he wasn't, due to some kind of error or somebody not paying attention. And I mean, nobody's perfect. And there are things that the cops did that are really, really good. Like when the murders actually occurred, the way that they quarantined the area and they took the bodies off, like, They did some good things, but there
I'll
were
give
other
them
things that they did that weren't very good. And I ended up finding a Chicago Tribune article that really praised the police for releasing this sketch of the suspect. And that's like the bare minimum, right? Like, you find a suspect and it's like you release the sketch. But that's just, you know, that's just my humble onion. But they did do a good job with the investigation at the beginning when the murders occurred, but there's a lot of things that could have gone better in this, I think.
Absolutely. Abso-freaking-lutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so on to the pretrial. Spec is evaluated by an impartial panel of 5 psychiatrists and 1 general surgeon who deem him competent to stand trial and sane at the time of the murders. On July 29th, 1966, Dick was transferred from Kermick Memorial Hospital to await trial in Peoria on February 14th, 1967. During these 6 months, he had twice weekly visits with part-time County Cook Jail psychiatrist Dr. Marvin Zipporin, or I don't know, Zip Porn, something like that.
Zeppelin?
Sure. It doesn't matter. Who prepared a discharge summary that listed depression, anxiety, guilt, and shame among Speck's emotions, but also a deep love for his family. It went on to note an obsessive compulsive personality, like I mentioned before, and a Madonna prostitute attitude towards women. Very, very bad. Very bad. Very, very bad. Are you familiar with that? Do you know, like, Madonna prostitute?
Is that a person?
So Madonna is like the Lady Madonna, Mary, Mother of Jesus. So basically, by saying he has a Madonna prostitute attitude towards women, he either puts them up on this pedestal like Madonna, Mary, the Mother of Jesus, or they're a prostitute and they don't deserve to
live.
I mean, live. Yeah. Very bad. Very, very bad. So he felt, according to Zipporn, he felt betrayed by women because he... Oh, wait, no. This is my opinion. This is where I reached my third glass of wine last night. So he felt betrayed by women because he is insecure. Speck also was diagnosed of having organic brain syndrome, which came from cerebral injuries suffered earlier in his life. Again, this is where when I was talking about, like, they speculated that he had had a brain injury. I didn't find that information in, like, the early years of his life, but here is where they say they diagnosed him with organic brain syndrome, and that they diagnosed him after he died. So, like, I'm inclined to believe them, but again, I didn't find any of that when I was researching his early life.
So did the injury make his brain organic?
I don't know. Maybe I'll get to that later. Oh, wait. No, I don't.
His brain was not organic, everyone.
His brain was not organic, guys. Not organic at all. Yeah, too many GMOs. So organic brain syndrome, which came from the cerebral injuries suffered earlier in Speck's life. He was competent to stand trial, however, but was insane at the time of the crime due to the effects of alcohol and drug use on his organic brain syndrome. So the panel of doctors earlier, remember, the five psychiatrists and the one general surgeon, they said he was sane at the time of the murder. Dr. Marvin Zipporn is saying he was not, that due to the effects of drugs and alcohol on his brain, which is GMO, not organic, he was insane when he killed these women. Don't understand where he got that from.
I'm wondering too.
I don't know. He did not testify. He did not testify and was fired after it was revealed that he was writing a book about Speck for money, which was published in 1967. I did not read this book, and I cannot remember what it's called, because Zip Porn seems like a douche canoe, so take that for what you will. Quote, Speck did not admit he did the murders. During interviews by Marvin Zip Porn, the psychiatrist Speck told him many times, I must have done it if everybody says I did. Speck claimed he blacked out from booze and dope that night. A group of psychiatrists found him competent to stand trial. Speck was declared sane, but a sociopath. So, once again, I'd like to remind you, he is a liar.
Absolutely.
He is a liar. He may or may not have been on drugs that night. He was probably drunk.
But maybe he was on drugs too.
Maybe he was completely sober. I mean, maybe he was pouring his beers out in the fern at the tavern and nobody knew. I mean, I don't know.
He poured him out after he stole him.
Exactly. I've just finished my second glass, so I'm going to go fill up my third glass. I'll be right back. All right, so on to the trial. On April 3rd, 1967, the trial begins in Peoria, Illinois, with a gag order on the press. I did not look up what gag order means, but I'm assuming that they could not record inside the courtroom.
Something to do with the dick. I don't know.
a gag order on dick. That's right. So, the prosecution. Assistant State's Attorney William Martin, representing the people of the state of Illinois. Against the defense. I didn't write their names down. So the prosecution has fingerprints. Dick also has no alibi. They have Cora's witness testimony, the survivor, which I have a note. She did an interview with an FBI agent, and her testimony ended up being 133 pages.
Oh, no.
I did not read her entire testimony, full disclosure. So there were also other witness testimonies. There was a knife, which was recovered from the Calumet River, or Chalumet, something like that. And then, of course, Dick's sperm was discovered at the crime scene, along with one of his t-shirts. So the defense
That'll do it.
The defense tried to suppress the evidence unsuccessfully. Don't know why. They also asked that Speck be given a single trial for each of the murders. And Martin was like, psh, yeah, let's do it. Because apparently it gave him an advantage. And then the last thing that he did was the defense wanted to move the trial away from Chicago because of the media. And that was granted. That's, I mean, pretty standard, I think. Wouldn't you agree?
I agree.
Yeah. So there's a lot of back and forth, all that, you know. And then Cora Amural gives her testimony, which I read to you earlier, the very, very graphic testimony of Dick entering the house and everything that he did to those poor women. Quote, the petite woman took the witness stand. The courtroom was riveted to every word that came from her mouth. Asked to identify the man who killed her friends, Cora calmly opened the door to the witness box, walked up to Speck, looked him in the eye, and said that he was the man. Speck looked disinterested. Dressed in a suit with black glasses, he looked like the boy next door. Meticulously, she demonstrated how she and her friends were herded into the bedroom and tied up. Often she pointed to the small-scale model of the townhouse, never faltering once. This was her day in court. This was her day in court. And this was her day in court. End quote. What a bad bitch.
Absolutely.
I mean, wow. She watched and she heard all of this happening. And she gets in court and she just demolishes him. And oh my gosh, like, what a bad bitch.
I love her. I mean, what if, like, I don't know. I just feel like with her being the only one left out of that whole situation, me personally, I feel like I would feel like survivor's guilt.
Right.
Like, I don't know. That's a lot to, like, that's like a whole nother level of victimization. Like,
exact. For her to turn right around the very next year, not even a full year after this happened, and to relive all of these moments, I mean, I cannot imagine. So, on April 15th, 1967, after 49 minutes of deliberation, the jury finds Dick Speck guilty and recommends the death penalty.
He's still in Chicago?
So the trial happened not in Chicago. The trial happened about 3 hours away in another town called Peoria, Illinois.
Oh, okay. So we're still in Illinois.
Yeah, we're still in Illinois, but they needed an impartial, unbiased jury. Which, I mean, they're still in Illinois. Like, they probably heard about it, but, I mean, he's guilty, so it doesn't matter.
It really doesn't.
So, convicted on, found guilty on April 15th, and then on June 5th, 1967, Judge Herbert J. Passion sentences him to the electric chair, which he immediately appeals. And then on the 22nd of November, 1968, the sentencing was upheld by the Illinois Supreme Court. On the 28th of June, 1971, however, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld Dick's conviction, but reversed his death sentence because the death sentence was declared unconstitutional in Furman versus Georgia on June 29th, 1972. So, on November 21st, 1972, Judge Richard Fitzgerald resentenced Speck to 400 to 1,200 years in prison. So that's a long time.
It is a long time.
He basically, like, immediately applied for parole because, again, he's entitled and insecure. So on the 15th of September, 1976, he was denied parole in 7 minutes.
Booyah.
Uh-huh. And he was denied parole at all six of his other parole hearings. So thank God. Speck was incarcerated at the Statesville Correctional Center in Crest Hill, Illinois. This is definitely where I got a little drunk. He was Statesville Correctional Center. He did some weird shit in prison, like collecting stamps and birds, but who gives a fuck how this breathing bedsore passed his time in prison? Though he refused all media requests, these quotes are from an interview with Bob Green in 1978, which was part of a broadcast by A&E in 1996. So I'm gonna read it like him once it gets to his parts. So
Justin, no.
So quote.
Please, you sound racist.
Quote. In this interview, Speck confessed to the murders for the first time publicly and said he thought he would get out of prison between now and the year 2000, at which time he hoped to run his own grocery store business. He told Green that one of his pleasures in prison was getting high, and when Green asked him if he compared himself to celebrity killers like John Dillinger, Speck replied, "Me? I'm not like Dillinger or anybody else. I'm freakish."
It's time for you to log off. It's time for you to go. Absolutely. Speck. Yeah, too much fun with that, and I do not like it.
Speck said that when he killed the nurses, he had no feelings, but things had changed. "I had no feelings at all that night. They said there was blood all over the place. I can't remember. It felt like nothing. I'm sorry as hell for those girls and their families, for me. If I had to do it over again, it would be a simple house burglary."
But it wasn't Dick. It wasn't.
Speck's final thought for the American people was, "Just tell them to keep up their hatred for me. I know it keeps up their morale, and I don't know what I'd do without them." End quote. What a disgusting meat brick. Truly the scorn of the earth.
Is that a direct quote?
No, that's my opinion. Oh, thank God we're still recording. Okay. I'm sorry for that. Sorry, listeners. Sorry, Dreek.
Apology death. Accepted. Oh,
shit. No, wait, this is a good one. So, 6:05 a.m., December 5th, 1991, Franklin Richard Speck died at 49 in the Silver Cross Hospital. Bye, Dick.
Round of applause.
On autopsy, they found he had an enlarged heart and occluded arteries. He had blown up to 220 pounds. His doughy face remained covered with pock marks. His body was bloated like a dead fish. No one claimed his body, no family, and no friends. Speck was cremated, his ashes thrown in an unknown location. So I think I forgot to mention this earlier when I talked about that video. Did I talk about the video already? I did, right?
What video? There's a
video? Yeah. When I was reading it in his voice. That was like, you can search that. You can find that video online. He did an interview with Bob Green. The actual interview is 2 hours long.
No, sir.
And it was showed in Congress up until a certain point in which, the video displayed Speck, performing oral sex on a fellow inmate. So in the part of the video that you can find on the A&E documentary, Speck talks about, he says all his quotes that I just told you, and he's also doing some other things. He takes his shirt off and he appears to be taking hormones, whether consensually or non-consensually is not really known. So he has titties, and he's also wearing silk panties. And he, there's like a whole bunch of cocaine. Like there's like a big pile.
And this is all in prison?
Like a big, oh yeah. There's also,
I'm confused.
Yeah. So there's also, this is being recorded. I'm assuming it's being recorded by that guy, Bob Green. And in the part of the video that you can see, he's sitting there with another inmate who's just cool as a cucumber, and he's wearing sunglasses and they're just chilling. And like, it cuts a few times, and at one of the cuts, there's just like this mound of cocaine, and they both start sniffing some cocaine, you know,
Justin, this
shit,
doesn't
paranormal cracktivity shit. Hell yeah.
It does not sound like it's real. None of this actually sounds like it's real.
Right? Like, how is this allowed? So this is why the video was showed to Congress, because it was like, this is what's happening in the jail. And Speck in the video also, he says something along the lines of, if only they knew how much fun I was having, they let me out of here.
And no.
It's actually revolting. It's truly revolting.
You're saying that forever, sir.
It is truly revolting. Oh my gosh. It's just scorn of the earth. So he died. Bye, Dick.
Thank you.
And he died of a heart attack, same as his biological father. Rest in peace.
Wonderful.
Frank Speck. 1921. Fun facts for 1921. The Gulf War. 1991. So the Gulf War, in early February 1991, Operation Desert Storm ground troops entered Kuwait, and by the end of the month, the nation was liberated from the Iraqi invasion.
Hooray!
Shout out to my dad. I don't know if you know this, Streak. My dad served in Desert Storm. He was a Marine. He served as an ammo technician. So shout out, Dad. I love you. Thank you for your service.
That is the coolest thing ever. That's so cool. My dad just became a grandpa.
Oh, congratulations. Wow.
I know. I'm so excited. I just want to see my little nephew.
Wow, that's amazing. Okay, so also in 1991 for our palate cleanser, Beauty and the Beast was released by Disney on November 22nd.
Period.
And the last bit of trivia, December 1991, the top song. Can you guess the artist?
1991,
December.
Mariah Carey.
Mm-mm.
No.
Two more guesses.
Shoot. 91. Celine Dion.
Mm-mm.
Is it a white woman?
No.
Is it a black man?
Yes.
Michael Jackson?
Yes! Ah! I knew you would get it, Jake. Ah! It's Michael Jackson. Can you guess which the song is?
1991.
I probably can't. That's why I asked you who the artist was, because I figured
you
could guess the artist.
Do you remember the time?
No.
No?
No. The top song of December 1991 was Black or White by Michael Jackson.
Okay. I was not expecting that.
Yeah. Released by Epic Records on November 11th, 1991. Fun fact.
Okay.
So, back to the story. Dr. Jan E. Liestema performed an autopsy on Speck's brain, in which he discovered that the hippocampus and amygdala were encroached upon each other and their boundaries were blurred. So the hippocampus controls your memory and the amygdala controls emotions and rage.
So they were just like...
So...
Was it like, I definitely think it was that like bump on the head when he was a kid that like just shifted things and mushed them together.
Yeah, true. It could have been that. He also could have been born with this. True.
Absolutely. He could have just been have been born this way. Combination of both.
Or a combination of both. Yeah, truly.
Nature and nurture.
Yeah. I'm not a scientist, so I don't exactly know what it means to say that the boundaries between memory and rage were blurred. Obviously, he had problems with his stepfather, but I don't know. Like, I don't know.
I know he was doing like a lot of like, I want to say like petty things when he was younger, like with the misdemeanors, but like,
yeah,
you didn't tell me anything about like rage, which is like. Where did it come from?
Until he just, like, totally exploded, you know?
Yeah.
But then again, he punched Mary Kay Pierce. Remember, he punched her and ruptured her liver before the murders.
That is so sad.
Dr. John Hughes examined photos of these samples along with brain wave tests performed on Dick in the 60s, and he attributes Speck's homicidal nature to a combination of the brain abnormalities, the violence Speck suffered at the hands of his alcoholic stepfather, and his own drinking and violence in Texas. So, like, just like what we were talking about, Dr. John Hughes was like, yeah, all of this stuff played into what he did. Yeah, and so after he died, his body was not claimed. His sister, I'm not sure which one, maybe Martha, told her kids that they can never tell people that Richard Speck was their uncle.
Damn.
Yeah, so Richard Speck was cremated, and the ashes were scattered somewhere. I don't fucking know where. I don't care. He was an asshole. So the very last part of this is going to be dedicated to the victims. So really quickly, I'm just going to read through all of the victims. And I have a update since we recorded this episode, actually. A little bit of information on the first two victims, Virgil Harris, who was sexually assaulted and burglarized by Speck on April 3rd, 1966. I was hardly able to find any information on her. Her occupation is listed as a clerk in a 1940 census from Cook County, Illinois. So I'm not sure if this is the same person. It's the only record that I could find of a Virgil Harris in Illinois, and they matched the age, being born around 1900, about 40 years old in 1940. So the second victim, the first murder victim, was Mary Kay, or Catherine Pierce, who was working at Frank's Place and was last seen on April 9th. She was reported missing on April 13th, and her body was found later that day. Mary Kay Pierce was born on December 18th, 1933. Her mother was Mamie Brash. Her father was Fred Brash, who was from Germany. She was married to Lawrence A. Pierce, who died in Monmouth on September 2012. And so now we're going to jump back in with the victims from the spree killing. So the first one, Cora Amural, obviously the only surviving victim, was born and raised in Batangueño. She boasts Batangas of the land of the Balisong, a double-handled folding pocket knife such that its blades, when enclosed, are concealed with the grooves of its handle. Being one of eight children, Corazon was the hardest working student in school, often praised for her grit and ability to adapt quickly to new and difficult situations despite her petite 4'11 frame. She wasn't easily intimidated. In fact, she stood with pride and strength and ended up studying at Far Eastern University in Manila, where she pursued a career in nursing after graduating. Corazon worked for 2 years in the Philippines before applying to work in the United States. So Cora, along with two of the other victims, Valentina and Merlita, were exchange students from the Philippines, and they had all traveled together in a group of 16. They came to Chicago on May 9th, and they were looking to go to school. They wanted to become nurses. So Cora traveled with the other two exchange students, and she is the only surviving victim of the massacre.
Poor Cora.
For the rest, poor Cora. Yeah, really sad. Poor Cora. For the rest of the victims, the remaining eight, I got these descriptions from an article in the Chicago Tribune from July 23rd, 1966. It's called "A Detailed Account of a Terrible Crime: The Accused Enigma to All" by David Halverson. Other than this, I've already mentioned all my other sources, Murderpedia and then Born to Raise Hell by Connie Filabelli. So the very last part of this, I'm just going to read off all of the victims and their descriptions from the Chicago Tribune that were murdered by Speck and his killing spree. And I'm still recording, so that's good. So in order of the killings, Suzanne Ferris was a deeply religious girl. She attended mass daily before going about the duties of a student nurse. Miss Ferris also was engaged. Her fiancé was Philip Jordan, the brother of Mary Ann Jordan. Suzanne was the daughter of John and Mary Ferris. She had a brother, John Jr. Suzanne was graduated from Aquinas High School. Mary Ann Jordan was the daughter of Mr. and Miss Philip Jordan Sr. The Jordans have four sons and a daughter besides Mary Ann. When she applied at the School of Nursing, Miss Jordan wrote, "I feel in this way I can best serve others." She was graduated from Aquinas Dominican High School in 1963. She was a member of the Future Nurses of America and the Sodality of Our Lady in high school. So Mary Ann Jordan was not a resident of this townhouse. She came over to have a sleepover with the girl that I mentioned previously, Suzanne Ferris.
Oh, no.
So Suzanne and Mary Ann were friends. They were the two that came in late. They were the last to arrive. They were both stabbed and strangled while trying to run away from Richard Speck. So, very sad. Next victim, Pamela Wilkening, was a well-mannered girl who was respected by everyone around her. She had been very devoted to her parents. If there was a school activity, Pamela was among the first to sign up. She was in the nurses' club, the pep club, the swimming group, and numerous other organizations at Thornton Fractional High School, from which she was graduated. She liked sports and racing cars. She was often bringing friends home for weekend visits. Pamela was the daughter of John and Lena Wilkening. She had a brother, Jack, 29, and Pamela was stabbed in the heart. Nina Schmail was engaged to Peter McNamee. She talked to him long and often of her hopes to become a good nurse. She wanted to be a psychiatric nurse. She loved children and liked to work with them. Miss Schmail took evening courses in chemistry to qualify for nursing school. She was queen of the student nurse dance this spring. Her parents were John and Dorothy Schmail. An older brother, John Jr., is a medical resident in Westside Veterans Hospital. Nina Schmail was stabbed in the neck and suffocated with a pillow. Valentina Paison, 24, was the daughter of a lawyer. She was graduated from Manila Central University School in 1965. She was stabbed and strangled. Merlita Gargulo was the daughter of a physician. She was graduated from Arellano University School of Nursing in 1964, and her throat was slashed. So Valentina and Merlita are the two exchange students that I mentioned before. There's not very much information on them. They both came to Chicago on May 9th in a group of 16 exchange students from the Philippines with Cora. Patricia Ann Matusik had seldom been happier than the day before she was slain. Children's Memorial Hospital notified her she would be accepted after her graduation in August. She loved children. Furthermore, definite plans could be made for her marriage to Robert Hinkle, a student nurse at Alexian Brothers Hospital. Then it was all shattered. She was the daughter of Mr. and Miss Joseph Matusik and had a sister, Betty Jo. Now, Patricia Ann, as I mentioned before, is believed to be the woman that Speck followed home. And she was killed in the same way that Ella May was killed. She was punched in the stomach.
Oh, no.
And her liver ruptured, and then she was strangled.
What a way to go.
Very, very sad. No, there's no reason why. I don't understand why. I don't know why he chose to kill her that way. It's just very violent, very aggressive.
And I feel like it would be slow too, you know, like
very slow. I don't know if I mentioned this. I'm reading these in order of their deaths. So Patricia Ann was the second to last murder. So she waited while her friends Merlita and Valentina and Nina and Pamela were all brought into a room one by one. And then it was her turn. And then Dick came back for Gloria Davy. Gloria Davy was a leader. She was president of the Student Nurses Association of Illinois from 1965 to 1966. She had been a sweetheart of the Future Farmers of America, shout out FFA, please sponsor us, at SS Peter and Paul High School, from which she was graduated in 1961. She organized and was the head of a cheerleading squad. She wrote a teenage column for a community newspaper, and she was always willing to help where help was needed. She was the leader in the townhouse, too. The others frequently sought her advice. Miss Davy had attended Northern Illinois University in DeKalb and was pledged to Alpha Xi Delta sorority. I'm sorry. She had worked as a nurse's aide in Our Lady of Mercy Hospital near Dyer. Her parents were Charles and Arline Davy, and she had four sisters and a brother. Miss Davy wrote poetry in her free time. Gloria Davy was raped and strangled.
They all sound like such good people.
They were all such good people. Oh my gosh. They were all so amazing. And Gloria, like, how did she do all that stuff? I mean, how did she have the time to do all that? And like I was saying before, like, imagine if Gloria had been home when this happened. Like, if she had gone in the closet with those girls and Gloria was like, all right, guys, there's four of us and one of him. I mean, could you imagine, like, it's just the situational thing, you know, like, it all could have happened differently.
Absolutely. And this case sucks.
This case, so, honestly, I wanted to choose a heavy hitter for the very first one. I know that everyone is going to be bummed out, but I feel like these women, these nurses, and plus LMA, who I feel like deserves more attention, they need their stories to be told. You know, this man, absolute scum of the earth, absolute dirtbag, douche canoe all the way, just an asshole. And this is for the victims. I want their names to be known. I want them to be known as people that were trying to help. And I want everyone to know that Dick Speck is
a speck on this earth, that
a fucking accident, literally the worst accident, like, rotten hell, honestly. So that's all I have. I wanted to end things with the victims. I wanted to end it with their lives. So yeah, that's the story of Dick Speck. That's the Charleston clap.
I was so excited when you told me that you were going to be doing the Charleston clap, and then I get brought into this, like, this case of just, like, I had never heard of this case, and it's, like, a wild case.
So bad. It's so bad. I've heard, so I definitely have heard Christine cover this on And That's Why We Drink, shout out, and I also listened to Last Podcast on the Left cover this. I don't think Morbid has covered this. But yeah, he's an awful, awful, awful person. He deserved everything that happened to him. And I hope he gets reborn as a pile of shit.
So something that's absolutely not even living.
Literally, yeah. I hope he gets... No, you know what? I hope he gets reborn as a blade of grass. And I hope he gets eaten.
A mosquito.
I hope he gets eaten. I hope he gets eaten by the nastiest smelling cow. And I hope that that cow chews him in its multiple stomachs over and over and over again. And then shats him into a cow patty that burns in the sun for the rest of eternity.
And that's where his life ends.
That's where his life ends. Yep.
How sad. Well, he deserved it.
He deserved every last bit of it.
Well, I guess that was a great first heavy hitter, Justin. I'm so happy.
Thank you guys so much for listening to our first episode. We do hope that you keep listening.
Pew, 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 pew.
And don't smoke crack. All right.
Absolutely.
Signing off. It's Justin.
It's Streak.
And this has been Paranormal Cracktivity Podcast. Bye-bye.
Pew, 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 pew.
No. This is probably gonna be like two hours and 50. No, it's probably gonna be like an hour and 45. Maybe an hour and. Oh yeah, the dead space. Yeah.
Absolutely. I have a lot of that.
Yeah. I'll cut what I can cut.
Oh, Justin, I feel so bad that you have to edit this.
This is gonna take me. But I mean, hey, fuck it. I don't have a job. Patreon. Hey, if you want to join our Patreon, why don't you subscribe to Patreon at Paranormal Cracktivity Podcast.
Period.
Ooh, ooh.